She kept reassuring her officers. This is only a small force. We can't let them stop us. But the bodies were falling steadily. The firing only seemed to increase, and she realized that what she was facing was not some aging home guard unit thrown together to pester them as they marched. It was a disciplined force that was systematically herding her troops, her hundreds of thousands of soldiers, into a killing ground along the road and the riverbank. And yet the gods still protected her. She walked among the cowering troops, standing upright, and not a bullet struck her. Soldiers fell all around her, but she was untouched. She knew how the soldiers interpreted it. The gods protect her. But she understood something completely different. The enemy has given orders not to harm me, and these soldiers are so well trained and disciplined that they are obeying the order. The force opposing them was not huge. The firepower wasn't overwhelming, but most of her soldiers weren't shooting at all. How could they? They couldn't see a target to shoot at, and the enemy would concentrate its fire on any force that tried to leave the road and get up the hills to sweep over the enemy lines. As far as she could see, if any of the enemy had died, it was by accident. I am Varus, she thought. I have led my troops, as Varus led the Roman legions, into a trap where we will all die. Die without even damaging the enemy. What was I thinking? This terrain was made for ambush. Why didn't I see that? Why was I so sure the enemy couldn't attack us here? Whatever you're sure the enemy can't do, but which would destroy you if they did it anyway, you must plan to counter. This was elementary. No one from Ender's Chish would have made such a mistake. Alai knew. He had warned her from the start. Her troops weren't ready for such a campaign. It would be a slaughter. And here they were now, dying all around her, the whole highway thick with corpses. Her men had been reduced to piling up the dead as makeshift bulwarks against enemy fire. There was no point in her issuing commands, because they would not be understood or obeyed. And yet her men fought on. Her cell phone rang. She knew at once that it was the enemy, calling her to ask her to surrender. But how could they know her cell phone number? Was it possible that Alai was with them? Verlomi. Not Alai, but she knew the voice. This is Suri. Suri Yawong. Were these FPE troops? Or Thai? How could Thai troops get across Burma and all the way up here? Not Chinese troops at all. Why was it suddenly so clear now? Why hadn't it been clear before when Alai was warning her? In their private talks, Alamander said it would all work because the Russians would have the Chinese army fully involved in the north. Whichever attack Hansu defended against, the other side would be able to rampage through China. Or if he tried to fight both, then each would destroy that part of his army in turn. What neither of them had realized was that Hansu was just as capable of finding allies as they were. Suri Yawong, whose love she had spurned, it felt like so many years ago, when they were children. Was this his vengeance because she had married Alai instead of him? Can you hear me, Veer? Yes, she said. I would rather capture these men, he said. I don't want to spend the rest of the day killing them all. Then stop! They won't surrender while you're still fighting. They worship you. They're dying for you. Tell them to surrender, and let the survivors go home to their families when the war is over. Tell Indians to surrender to Siamese! As soon as she said it, she regretted it. Once she had cared first for the lives of her men. Now, suddenly, she found herself speaking out of injured pride. Veer, said Suri, they're dying for nothing. Save their lives. She broke the connection. She looked at the men around her, the ones that were alive, crouching behind piles of their comrades' bodies, searching for some kind of target out in the trees, up the slopes, and seeing nothing. They've stopped shooting, said one of her surviving officers. Enough men have died for my pride, said Verlomi. May the dead forgive me. I will live 1,000 lives to make up for this one vain, stupid day. She raised her voice. Lay down your weapons. Verlomi says, lay down your weapons and stand up with your hands in the air. Take no more lives. Lay down your weapons. We will die for you, Mother India, cried one of the men. Satyagraha, shouted Verlomi. Bear what must be borne. Today what you must bear is surrender. Mother India commands you to live so you can go home and comfort your wives and make babies to heal the great wounds that have been torn in the heart of India today. Some of her words and all of the meaning of her message were passed up and down the highway of corpses. She set the example by raising her hands and walking out beyond the wall of bodies into the open. Of course, no one shot at her, because no one had during the whole battle. But soon others joined her. They lined up on the same side of the corpse wall that she had chosen, leaving their weapons behind them. From out of the trees on both sides of the highway, wary Thai soldiers emerged, guns still at the ready. They were covered with sweat, and the frenzy of killing was only just leaving them. Verlomi turned and looked behind her. Emerging from the trees on the other side of the road was Suryawang. She walked back over the walls of corpses to meet him in the grass on the other side. They stopped when they were 3 paces apart. She gestured up and down the road. So, this is your work? No, Verlomi, he said sadly. It's yours. Yes, she said. I know. Will you come with me to tell the other 2 armies to stop fighting? They'll only give up when you tell them to. Yes, she said. No. Phone them and see if they obey. If I try to lead you away right now, these soldiers will take up arms again to stop me. For some reason, they still worship you. In India, we worship the destroyer, along with Vishnu and Brahma. But I never knew that you served Shiva, said Suryawang. She had no answer for him. She used her cell phone and made the calls. They're trying to stop the men from fighting. Then there was silence between them for a while. She could hear the barked commands of the Thai soldiers, forming her men into small groups and beginning their march down the valley. Aren't you going to ask about your husband? Said Suri. What about him? Are you so sure your Muslim co-conspirators killed him then? Nobody was going to kill him, she said. They were only going to confine him until after the victory. Suri laughed bitterly. You spent this long fighting the Muslims, Veer, and you still don't understand them any better than that. This isn't a chess game. The person of the king is not sacred. I never sought his death. You took away his power, said Suri. He tried to stop you from doing this, and you plotted against your own husband. He was a better friend to India than you ever were. His voice cracked with passion. You cannot say anything to me that's crueler than what I am now saying to myself. The girl Verlomi, so brave, so wise, said Suri. Does she still exist? Or has the goddess destroyed her, too? The goddess is gone, said Verlomi. Only the fool, only the murderer remains. A field radio crackled at his waist. Something was said in Thai. Please come with me now, Verlomi. One army is surrendering, but the other shot the officer you telephoned when he tried to give the order. A chopper approached them, landed. They got on. In the air, Suryawang asked her, What will you do now? I'm your prisoner. What will you do? You're Peter Wiggins' prisoner. Thailand has joined the Free People. She knew what that would mean to Suryawang. Thailand, even the name meant land of the free. Peter's new nation had co-opted the name of Suryawang's homeland, and now his homeland would no longer be sovereign. They had given up their independence. Peter Wigan would be master of all.
I'm sorry, she said.
Sorry? Because my people will be free within their borders, and there'll be no more wars?
What about my people? She asked.
You're not going back to them, said Suri.
How could I, even if you let me? How could I possibly face them?
I was hoping that you would face them, by vid, to help undo some of the damage you've done today.
What could I possibly say or do?
They still worship you. If you disappear now, if they never hear of you again, India will be ungovernable for 100 years.
Verlomi answered truthfully, India has always been ungovernable.
Less governable than ever, said Suri. But if you speak to them, if you tell them, I will not tell them to surrender to yet another foreign power, not after they've been conquered and occupied by Chinese and then Muslims.
If you ask them to vote, to freely decide whether to live in peace within the free people, and give Peter Wigan the victory.
Why are you angry with Peter? What did he ever do but help you win your nation's freedom in every way that was possible to him?
It was true. Why was she so angry?
Because he had beaten her.
Peter Wigan, said Suri Awang, has the right of conquest. His troops destroyed your army in combat. He showed mercy he didn't have to show.
You showed mercy.
I followed Peter's instructions, said Suri Awang. He does not want any foreign occupiers in India. He wants the Muslims out. He wants only Indians to govern Indians. Joining the FPE means exactly that, a free India, but an India that doesn't need and therefore doesn't have a military.
A nation without an army is nothing, said Valomi. Any enemy can destroy them.
That's the hegemon's work in the world. He destroys the aggressors so peaceful nations can remain free. India was the aggressor. Under your leadership, India was the invader. Now, instead of punishing your people, he offers them freedom and protection if they only give up their weapons.
Isn't that satyagraha, Veer? To give up what you once valued, because now you serve a greater good?
Now you teach me about satyagraha?
Hear the arrogance in your voice, Veer.
Abashed, she looked away from him.
I teach you about satyagraha because I lived it for years, hiding myself utterly so that I would be the one Ashil trusted in the moment when I could betray him and save the world from him. I had no pride at the end of that. I had lived in filth and shame for... forever. But Bean took me back and trusted me, and Peter Wigan acted as if he had known all along who I really was. They accepted my sacrifice.
Now I ask you, Veer, for your sacrifice. Your satyagraha. Once you put everything on the altar of India, then your pride nearly undid what you had accomplished. I ask you now, will you help your people live in peace, the only way that peace can be had in this world, by joining with the free people of Earth?
She felt the tears streaming down her face, like that day when she was making the video of the atrocities. Only today, she was the one who had caused the deaths of all these Indian boys. They came here to die because they loved and served her. She owed their families something.
Whatever will help my people live in peace, she said, I'll do.
Chapter 25. Letters. From Bean, at wherever the hell I am, to Graf, pilgrimage@kalman.gov. Ray, did we actually do it? I can't believe you still have me hooked up to the nets. This continues by Ansible after we're moving at relativistic speeds? The babies are fine here. There's room enough for them to crawl. A library big enough, I think they won't be lacking for interesting reading or viewing material for...
Weeks.
It will only be weeks, right? What I'm wondering is, did we do it? Did I fulfill your goal? I look at the map and there's still nothing inevitable about it. Han Su gave his farewell speech just like Vlad and Alai and Verlomi. Makes me feel cheated. They got to bid the world farewell before they disappeared into this good night. Then again, they had nations to try to sway. I never really had anybody who followed me. Never wanted them. That's the thing, I guess, that set me apart from the rest of the Jeesh. I was the only one who didn't wish I were Ender. So look at the map, Hiram. Will they buy Hanzu's plan of dividing China into six nations and all of them joining the Free Peoples? Or will they stay unified and still join? Or look for another emperor? Will India recover from the humiliation of Verlomi's defeat? Will they follow her advice and embrace the FPE? Nothing's assured, and I have to go. I know, you'll tell me by Ansible when anything interesting happens. And in a way, I don't care. I'm not going to be there. I'm not going to have any effect on it. In another way, I care even less than that. Because I never did care. Yet I also care with my whole heart. Because Petra is there with the only babies I actually wanted. The ones that don't have my defects. With me, I have only the cripples. And my only fear is that I'll die before I've taught them anything. Don't be ashamed when you see your life coming to an end and you haven't found a cure for me yet. I never believed in the cure. I thought there was enough of a chance to take this leap into the night, and cure or not, I knew that I didn't want my defective children to live long enough to make my mistake and reproduce and keep this valuable, terrible curse going on generation after generation. Whatever happens, it's all right. And then it occurs to me. What if Sister Carlotta was right? What if God is waiting for me with open arms? Then all I'm doing is postponing my reunion. I think of meeting God. Will it be like when I met my father and mother? I almost wrote Nikolai's parents. I liked them. I wanted to love them. But I knew that Nikolai was the child she bore, the child they raised. And I was from nowhere. And for me, my father was a little girl named Poke, and my mother was Sister Carlotta, and they were dead. Who were these other people, really? Will meeting God be like that? Will I be disappointed with the real thing, because I prefer the substitute I made do with? Like it or not, Hiram, you were God in my life. I didn't invite you. I didn't even like you. But you kept meddling. And now you've sent me into outer darkness with a promise to save me. A promise I don't believe you can keep. But at least you aren't a stranger. I know you. And I think that you honestly meant well. If I have to choose between an omnipotent God who leaves the world in this condition and a God who has only a little bit of power but really cares and tries to make things better, I'll take you every time. Go on playing God, Hiram. You're not bad at it. Sometimes you kind of get it right. Why am I writing like this? We can email whenever we want. The thing is, nothing's going to happen here, so I'll have nothing to tell you. And nothing you have to tell me is going to matter to me all that much the farther I get from Earth. So this is the right time for these valedictories. I hope Peter succeeds in uniting the world in peace. I believe he's still got a couple of big wars ahead of him. I hope Petra remarries. When she asks you what to think, tell her I said this. I want my children to have a father in their lives. Not some absent legend of a father, a real one. So as long as she chooses somebody who will love them and tell them they've done okay, then do it. Be happy. I hope you live to see colonies established and the human race thriving on other worlds. It's a good dream. I hope these crippled children I have with me find something interesting to do with their lives after I'm dead. I hope Sister Carlotta and Poke are there to meet me when I die. Sister Carlotta can tell me I told you so. And I can tell them both how sorry I am that I couldn't save their lives. After all the trouble they went to save mine. Enough. Time to switch on the gravity regulator and get this boat out to sea.
From Graf, pilgrimage@callman.gov to Bean at wherever the hell I am. Ray, you did enough. You did enough, Bean. You only had a little time, and you sacrificed so much of it to helping Peter and me and Mazer. All that time that could have belonged to Petra and you and your babies. You did enough. Peter can take it from here. As for all that God business, I don't think the real God has as bad a track record as you think. Sure, a lot of people have terrible lives by some measure, but I can't think of anybody who's had it tougher than you. And look what you've become. You don't want to give God the credit because you don't think he exists. But if you're going to blame him for all the crap, kid, you got to give him credit for what grows from that fertilized soil. What you said about Petra getting a real father for your kids, I know you were talking about yourself, but I have to say it because it's true, and you deserve to hear it. Bean, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of myself because I actually got to know you. I remember sitting there after you figured out what was really going on in the war against the buggers. What do I do with this kid? We can't keep a secret from him. What I decided was, I'll trust him. You lived up to my trust. You exceeded it. You're a great soul. I looked up to you long before you got so tall. You did okay.
The plebiscite was over in Russia, and it joined the FPE. The Muslim League was broken up, and the most belligerent nations had been subdued, for now. Armenia was safe. Petra sent her army home on the same civilian trains that had brought them to Moscow. It had taken a year. During that time, she missed her babies, but she couldn't bear to see them. She refused to let them be brought to her. She refused to take even a brief leave to see them. Because she knew that when she came home, there would only be five of them. And the two she knew the best, and therefore loved the best, would not be there. Because she knew that she would have to face the rest of her life without Bean. So she kept herself busy, and there was no shortage of important work to do. She told herself, next week, I'll take a leave and go home. Then her father came to her and bulled his way past the aides and clerks that fenced her off from the outside world. Truth to tell, they were probably glad to see him and let him through. Because Petra was hell on wheels, and terrified everybody around her. Father came to her with an attitude of steel. Get out of here, he said. What are you talking about? Your mother and I lost half your childhood because they took you away. You're cheating yourself out of some of the sweetest time in the lives of your children. Why? What are you afraid of? The great soldier and babies terrify you? I don't want this conversation, she said. I'm an adult. I make my own decisions. You don't grow out of being my daughter, father said. Then he loomed over her, and for a moment she had a childish fear that he was going to to spank her. All he did was put his arms around her and hug her. Tight.
You're suffocating me, Papa.
Then it's working.
I mean it.
If you have breath to argue with me, then I'm not done.
She laughed. He let her out of the hug, but still held her shoulders.
You wanted these children more than anything, and you were right. Now you want to avoid them because you think you can't bear the grief of the ones that aren't there. And I tell you, you're wrong. And I know, because I was there for Stefan. During all the years you were gone. I didn't hide from him because I didn't have you.
I know you're right, said Petra. You think I'm stupid? I didn't decide not to see them. I just kept putting it off.
Your mother and I have written to Peter, begging him to order you home. And all he said was, she'll come home when she can't help it.
You couldn't listen to him? He is the hegemon of the whole world.
Not even half the world yet, said Father. And he might be hegemon of nations, but he's got no authority inside my family.
Thank you for coming, Papa. I'm demobilizing my troops tomorrow and sending them home across borders where they won't need passports because it's all part of the free people of Earth. I did something while I was here, but now I'm done. I was going home anyway. But now I'll do it because you told me to. See, I'm willing to be obedient as long as you order me to do what I was going to do anyway. The Free People of Earth had four capitals now. Bangkok had been added to Rwanda, Rotterdam, and Blackstream. But it was Blackstream, Hiber Opritu, where the hegemon lived. And that was where Peter had had her children moved. He hadn't even asked her permission, and it made her furious when he informed her what he had done. But she was busy in Russia, and Peter said that Rotterdam wasn't home to her, and it wasn't home to him, and he was going home, and keeping her kids where he could make sure they were getting cared for. So it was Brazil she came home to. And it did feel good. Moscow's winter had been a nightmare, even worse than Armenia's winters. And she liked the feel of Brazil, the pace of life, the way they moved, the football in the streets, the way they were never quite dressed, the music of the Portuguese language coming out of the neighborhood bars, along with batuque and samba and laughter, and the pungent smell of pinga. She took a car part of the way, but then paid him and told him to deliver her bags to the compound, and she walked the rest of the way. Without actually planning it, she found herself walking past the little house where she and Bean had lived when they weren't inside the compound. The house had been changed. She realized it was connected to the house next door by a couple of rooms added in, and the garden wall between them had been torn down. It was one big house now. What a shame. They can't leave well enough alone. Then she saw the name on the little sign on the wall beside the gate. Delphiki. She opened the gate without clapping hands for permission. She knew now what had happened, but she also couldn't believe that Peter had gone to such trouble. She opened the door and walked in, and there was Bean's mother in the kitchen, making something that had a lot of olives and garlic in it.
Oh, said Petra, I'm sorry. I didn't know you... I thought you were in Greece.
The smile on Mrs. Delphiki's face was all the answer Petra needed.
Of course you come in. It's your house. I'm the visitor. Welcome home.
You came to... You're here to take care of the babies.
We work for the FPE now, and our jobs brought us here. But I couldn't stand to be away from my grandchildren. I took a leave of absence. Now I cook and change nasty diapers and scream at the empregadas.
Where are the...
Nap time, said Mrs. Delfiki. But I promise you, little Andrew, he's only faking. He never sleeps. Whenever I go in, his eyes are just a little tiny bit open.
They won't know me, said Petra.
She dismissed that with a wave.
Of course not. But you think they're going to remember that?
Nothing that happens before age 3.
I'm so glad to see you. Did he say goodbye to you?
He wasn't sentimental that way, said Mrs. Delfiki. But yes, he called us. And sent us nice letters.
I think it hit Nikolai harder than us, because he knew Julian better. From battle school, you know. But Nikolai is married now, did you know? So pretty soon, maybe another grandchild.
Not that we have a shortage. You and Julian did very well by us.
If I'm very quiet and don't wake them, can I go see them? We divided them into 2 rooms.
Andrew shares 1 room with Bella, because he never sleeps, but she can sleep through anything. Julian and Petra and Ramon are in the other room. They need it dimmer. But if you wake them, it's not a problem. All their cribs have the sides down because they climb out anyway.
They're walking?
Running, climbing, falling off things.
They're more than a year old, Petra. They're normal children. It almost set her off, because it reminded her of the children who weren't normal. But that wasn't what Mrs. Delfiki meant, and there was no reason to punish her for a chance remark by bursting into tears. So the 2 who bore the names of the children she grieved for most were sharing a room. She had courage enough to face this. She went there first. Nothing about these babies reminded her of the ones who were gone. They were so big. Toddlers, not babies now. And, true to reputation, Andrew's eyes were already open. He turned to look at her. She smiled at him. He closed his eyes and pretended to be asleep. Well, let him retreat and decide what he thinks of me. I'm not going to demand that they love me when they don't even know me. She walked to Bella's crib. She was sleeping hard, her black curls tight and wet against her head. The Delfiki genetic heritage was so complicated. Bella really showed Bean's African roots, whereas Andrew looked Armenian, period. She touched one of Bella's curls, and the girl didn't stir. Her cheek was hot and damp. She's mine, thought Petra. She turned and saw that Andrew was sitting up in bed, regarding her soberly.
Hello, Mama, he said.
It took her breath away.
How did you know me?
Picture, he said.
Do you want to get up?
He looked at the clock on the top of the dresser.
Not time.
These were normal children? How would Mrs. Delfiki know what normal was anyway? Nikolai wasn't exactly stupid. Though they weren't so brilliant, they were both wearing diapers. Petra walked over to Andrew and held out her hand. What do I think he is? A dog that I give my hand to sniff? Andrew took hold of a couple of her fingers, just for a moment, as if to make sure she was real.
Hello, Mama. May I kiss you?
He lifted his face and puckered up. She leaned down and kissed him. The touch of his hands, the feel of his little kiss, the curl on Bella's cheek. What had she been waiting for? Why had she been afraid? Fool. I'm a fool. Andrew lay back down and closed his eyes. As Mrs. Delfiki had warned, it was completely unbelievable. She could see the whites of his eyes through the partly open slits.
I love you,
she whispered.
Love you too,
murmured Andrew.
Petra was glad that someone had said those words to him so often that the answer came by rote. She crossed the hall into the other room. It was much darker. She couldn't see well enough to dare to cross the room. It took a few moments for her eyes to grow used to the dark and make out the three beds.
Would she know Ramon when she saw him?
Someone moved to her left. She was startled, and she was a soldier. In a moment, she was in a defensive crouch, ready to spring.
Only me, whispered Peter Wiggin.
You didn't have to come, and
he held a finger to his lips. He walked over to the farthest crib.
Ramon, he whispered.
She came and stood over the crib. Peter reached down and flipped something. A paper.
What is it?
She asked, in a whisper. He shrugged. If he didn't know what it was, why had he pointed it out to her? She pulled it out from under Ramon. It was an envelope, but it didn't contain much. Peter took her gently by the elbow and guided her out the door. Once they were in the hall, he said softly,
You can't read in that light. And when Ramon wakes up, he's going to look for it and be very upset if it isn't there.
What is it?
Ramon's paper, said Peter.
Petra, Bean put it there before he left. I mean, not there. It was in Rotterdam. But he tucked it under Ramon's diaper as he was lying asleep in bed. He meant you to find it there. So it's been there every night of his life. It's only been peed on twice.
From Bean.
The emotion she could deal with best was anger.
You knew he had written this, and...
Peter kept the both of them moving out of the hall and into the parlor. He didn't give it to me or anyone else to deliver, unless you count Ramon. He gave it to Ramon's butt.
But to make me wait a year before...
Nobody thought it would be a year, Petra. He said it very gently, but the truth of it stung. He always had the power to sting her, and yet he never shrank from doing it.
I'll leave you alone to read it, he said.
You mean you didn't come here for my homecoming so you could find out what was in it?
Petra?
Mrs. Delphiki stood in the doorway to the parlor. She looked mildly shocked.
Peter didn't come here for you. He's here all the time.
Petra looked at Peter, and then back at Mrs. Delphiki.
Why?
They climb all over him, and he puts them down for their nap. They obey him a lot better than me.
The thought of the hegemon of Earth coming over to play with her children seemed freakish to her. And then it seemed worse than freakish. It seemed completely unfair. She pushed him.
You came to my house and played with my children?
He didn't show any reaction. He also stood his ground.
They're great kids.
Let me find that out, will you? Let me find it out for myself.
Nobody's stopping you.
You were stopping me. I was doing your work in Moscow, and you were here playing with my kids.
I offered to bring them to you.
I didn't want them in Moscow. I was busy.
I offered you leave to come home, time after time.
And let the work fall apart?
Petra, said Mrs. Delphiki, Peter has been very good to your children, and to me, and you're behaving very badly.
No, Mrs. Delphiki, said Peter,
this is only slightly badly. Petra's a trained soldier, and the fact that I'm still standing...
Don't tease me out of this!
Petra burst into tears.
I've lost a year of my baby's lives, and it was my own fault. Do you think I don't know that?
There was a crying sound from one of the bedrooms. Mrs. Delphiki rolled her eyes and went down the hall to rescue whoever it was that needed rescuing.
"You did what you had to do," said Peter. "Nobody's criticizing you."
"But you could take time for my children."
"I don't have any of my own," said Peter.
"Is that my fault?"
"I'm just saying I had time, and I owed it to Bean."
"You owe more than that."
"But this is what I can do."
She didn't want Peter Wiggin to be the father figure in her children's lives. "Petra, I'll stop if you want. They'll wonder why I don't come, and then they'll forget. If you don't want me here, I'll understand. This is yours and Bean's, and I don't want to intrude. And yes, I did want to be here when you opened that."
"What's in it?"
"I don't know." "Didn't have one of your guys steam it open for you?" Peter just looked a little irritated. Mrs. Delphiki came into the room carrying Ramon, who was whimpering and saying, "My paper!"
"I should have known," said Peter. Petra held up the envelope.
"Here it is," she said.
Ramon reached for it insistently.
Petra handed it to him.
"You're spoiling him," said Peter.
"This is your mama, Ramon," said Mrs. Delphiki. "She nursed you when you were little. He was the only one that wasn't biting me by the time..." She couldn't think of a way to finish the sentence that wouldn't involve speaking of Bean or the other two children, the ones that had to go on solid food because they got teeth so incredibly young. Mrs. Delphiki wasn't giving up.
"Let your mama see the paper, Ramon."
Ramon clutched it tighter. Sharing was not yet on his agenda. Peter reached out, snagged the envelope, and held it out to Petra. Ramon immediately began to wail.
"Give it back to him," said Petra. "I've waited this long."
Peter got his finger under the corner, tore it open, and extracted a single sheet of paper.
"If you let them get their way just because they cry, you'll raise a bunch of whiny brats that nobody can stand."
He handed her the paper and gave the envelope back to Ramon, who immediately quieted down and started examining the transformed object. Petra held the paper and was surprised to see that it was shaking, which meant her hand was shaking. She didn't feel like she was trembling. And then suddenly Peter was holding her by her upper arms and helping her to the sofa, and her legs weren't working very well.
"Come on, sit here. It's a shock, that's all."
"I've got your snack already," said Mrs. Delphiki to Ramon, who was trying to get his whole forearm inside the envelope.
"Are you all right?" Peter asked.
Petra nodded.
"Want me to go now so you can read this?"
She nodded again. Peter was in the kitchen saying goodbye to Ramon and Mrs. Delphiki as Andrew padded down the hall. He stopped in the archway of the parlor and said,
"Time?"
"Yes, it's time, Andrew," said Petra. She watched him toddle on toward the kitchen, and then a moment later she heard his voice.
"Mama,"
he announced.
"That's right," said Mrs. Delphiki. "Mama's home."
"Bye, Mrs. Delphiki," Peter said.
A moment later, Petra heard the door open.
"Wait a minute, Peter," she called.
He came back inside. He closed the door. As he came back into the parlor, she held the paper out to him. "I can't read it." Peter didn't ask why. Any fool could see the tears in her eyes.
"You want me to read it to you?"
"Maybe I can get through it, if it isn't his voice I hear," she said. Peter opened it. "It isn't long." "I know." He started reading aloud, softly, so only she could hear. "I love you," he said. There's one thing we forgot to decide. We can't have two pairs of children with the same name. So I've decided that I'm going to call the Andrew that's with me Ender, because that's the name we called him when he was born. And I'll think of the Andrew that's with you as Andrew. The tears were streaming down Petra's face now, and she could hardly keep herself from sobbing. For some reason, it tore her apart to realize that Bean was thinking about such things before he left.
"Want me to go on?" asked Peter.
She nodded.
"And the Bella that's with you, we'll call Bella. Because the one that's with me, I've decided to call her Carlotta." She lost it. Feelings she'd had pent up inside her for a year, feelings that her underlings had begun to think she didn't have, burst out of her now. But only for a minute. She got control of herself, and then waved to him to continue. "And even though she isn't with me, the little girl we named after you, when I tell the kids about her, I'm going to call her Poke, so they don't get her confused with you. You don't have to call her that, but it's because you're the only Petra I actually know, and Poke ought to have somebody named after her." Petra broke down. She clung to Peter, and he held her like a friend, like a father. Peter didn't say anything. "No, it's all right," or "I understand." Maybe because it wasn't all right, and he was smart enough to know he couldn't understand. When he did speak, it was after she was much calmer and quieter, and another of the children had walked past the archway and loudly proclaimed, "Lady crying!" Petra sat up and patted Peter's arm and said, "Thank you. I'm sorry." "I wish his letter had been longer," said Peter. "It was obviously just a last-minute thought."
"It was perfect," said Petra. "He didn't even sign it." "Doesn't matter."
"But he was thinking of you and the children, making sure you and he would think of all the children by the same names."
She nodded, afraid of starting again.
"I'm going to go now," said Peter. "I won't come back till you invite me."
"Come back when you usually do," she said. "I don't want my homecoming to cost the children somebody they love."
"Thanks," he said.
She nodded. She wanted to thank him for reading it to her and being so decent about her crying all over his shirt, but she didn't trust herself to speak, so she just sort of waved. It was a good thing she had cried herself out. When she went into the kitchen and washed her face and listened to little Petra, to Poke, say, "Lady crying," again, she was able to be very calm and say, "I was crying because I'm so happy to see you. I've missed you. You don't remember me, but I'm your mama."
"We show them your picture every morning and night," said Mrs. Delphiki, "and they kiss the picture."
"Thank you."
"The nurses started it before I came," she said.
"Now I get to kiss my boys and girls myself," she said. "Will that be all right? No more kissing the picture?" It was too much for them to understand, and if they wanted to keep kissing the picture for a while, that would be fine with her, too. Just like Ramon's envelope. No reason to take away from them something that they valued.
"By your father's age," Petra said silently, "he was on his own, trying not to starve to death in Rotterdam. But you're all going to catch up with him and pass him by. When you're in your 20s and out of college and getting married, he'll still be 16 years old, crawling through time as his starship races through space. When you bury me, he'll not have turned 17 yet. And your brothers and sister will still be babies, not as old as you are. It will be as if they never change. Which means it's exactly as if they had died.
Loved ones who die never change either. They're always the same age in memory. So what I'm going through isn't something so different. How many women became widows in the war? How many mothers have buried babies that they hardly had time to hold? I'm just part of the same sentimental comedy as everyone else. The sad parts always followed by laughter, the laughter always by tears. It wasn't until later, when she was alone in her bed, the children asleep for the night, Mrs. Delfiki gone next door, or rather to the other wing of the same house, that she was able to bring herself to read Bean's note again. It was in his handwriting. He had done it in a hurry, and in spots it was barely legible. And the paper was stained. Peter hadn't been joking about Ramon peeing on the envelope a couple of times. She turned the light out and meant to go to sleep. And then something occurred to her, and she switched on the light again and fumbled for the paper, and her eyes were so bleary she could hardly read. So maybe she had actually fallen asleep, and this thought had woken her out of a sound slumber. The letter began, "There's one thing we forgot to decide." But when Peter read it, he had started with, "I love you." He must have scanned over the letter and realized that Bean never said it, that it was just a note that Bean had jotted at the last moment, and Peter worried that she might be hurt by the omission. He couldn't have known that Bean just didn't put that kind of thing in writing, except obliquely, because the whole note said, "I love you," didn't it? She turned the light off again, but still held the letter. Bean's last message to her. As she drifted off again, the thought passed briefly through her mind. When Peter said it, he wasn't reading at all.
Chapter 26. Speak for Me. From Peter Wiggin, hegemon at freepeopleofearth.fp.gov, to Valentine Wiggin, historian at bookweb.com/authorsservice. Ray, congratulations. Dear Valentine, I read your 7th volume, and you're not just a brilliant writer, which we always knew, but also a thorough researcher and a perceptive and honest analyst.
I knew
Hiram Graff and Mazur Rackham very well before they died.
And you treated them with absolute fairness. I doubt they would dispute a word of your book, even where they did not come off as perfect. They were always honest men, even when they lied their zophas off. The work of the hegemon's office is pretty slight these days. The last actual military ventures that were needed took place more than a decade ago, the last gasp of tribalism, which we managed to mostly put down with a show of force. Since then, I've tried to retire half a dozen times. No, wait. I'm talking to an historian. Twice. But they don't believe I mean it, and they keep me in office. They even ask my advice sometimes. And to return the favor, I try not to reminisce about how we did things in the early days of the FPE. Only the good old USA refuses to join the FPE, and I have hopes they'll get off their don't-tread-on-me kick and do the right thing. Polls keep saying that Americans are sick of being the only people in the world who don't get a chance to vote in the world elections. I may see the whole world formally united before I die. And even if I don't, we've got peace on Earth. Petra says hi. Wish you could have known her, but that's star travel. Tell Ender that Petra is more beautiful than ever. He should eat his heart out. And our grandchildren are so adorable that people applaud when we take them out for walks. Speaking of Ender, I read The Hive Queen. I heard about it before, but never read it till you included it at the end of your last volume. But before the index, or I would never have seen it. I know who wrote it. If he can speak for the buggers, surely he can speak for me. Peter. Not for the first time, Peter wished they made a portable Ansible. Of course, it would make no economic sense. Yes, they miniaturized it as much as possible to put it on starships, but the Ansible only made an important difference in communication across the void of space. It saved hours for within-system communication, decades for communication with the colonies and the ships in flight. It just wasn't a technology designed for chatting. There were a few privileges that came with the vestiges of power. Peter might be over 70, and, as he often pointed out to Petra, an old 70, an ancient 70. But he was still hegemon, and the title had once meant enormous power. It once meant attack choppers in flight, and armies and fleets in motion. It once meant punishment for aggression, collection of taxes, enforcement of human rights laws, cleaning up political corruption. Peter remembered when the title was such an empty joke, they gave it to a teenage boy who had written cleverly on the nets. Peter had brought power to the office. And then, because he gradually stripped away its functions and assigned them to other officials in the FPE, or EarthGov, as people called it, as often as not, he had returned the position to a figurehead position. But not a joke. He was no longer a joke, and never would be again. Not a joke, but not necessarily a good thing either. There were plenty of people left alive who remembered the hegemon as the coercive power that shattered their dream of how Earth ought to be, though usually their dream was everyone else's nightmare. And historians and biographers had often had at him, and would do it again, forever. The thing about the historians was they could arrange the data all neatly in rows, but they kept missing what it was for. They kept inventing the strangest motives for people. There was the biography of Verlomi, for instance, that made her an idealistic saint and blamed Suryawong, of all people, for the slaughter that ended Verlomi's military career. Never mind that Verlomi herself repudiated that interpretation, writing by Ansible from the colony on Andra. Biographers were always irritated when their subject turned out to be alive. But Peter hadn't bothered to answer any of them, even the ones that attacked him quite savagely, blaming him for everything that went badly and giving others the credit for everything that went well. Petra would fume over some of them for days until he begged her not to read them anymore. But he couldn't resist reading them himself. He didn't take it personally. Most people never had biographies written about them. Petra herself had only had a couple about her, and they were both of the great women or role models for girls variety, not serious scholarship. Which bothered Peter because he knew what they seemed to neglect— that after all the other members of Ender's Geesh left Earth and went out to the colonies, she stayed and ran the FPE Defense Ministry for almost 30 years, until the position became more of a police department than anything else, and she insisted on retiring to play with the grandchildren. She was there for everything, Peter said to her when he was griping about this. You were Ender's and Bean's friend in battle school. You taught Ender how to shoot, for heaven's sake. You were in his Geesh, but at those points, Petra would shush him. I don't want those stories told, she said. I wouldn't come off very well if the truth came out. Peter didn't believe it. And you could skip all of that and start when she returned to Earth and... Wasn't it Petra who, when the Geesh was almost all kidnapped, found a way to get a message out to Bean? Wasn't she the one who knew Ashiel better than anybody that he didn't succeed in killing? She was one of the great military leaders of all time, and she also married Julian Delphiki, the giant of legend, and then Peter the hegemon, another legend, and on top of all that raised 5 of the children she had with Bean and 5 more she had with Peter. And no biography. So why should he complain that there were dozens about him and every one of them got simple, obvious things wrong, things you could actually check, let alone the more arcane things like motive and secret agreements and... And then Valentine's book on the Bugger Wars started to come out, volume by volume. One on the first invasion, two on the second, the one Maser Rackham won. Then four volumes on the third invasion, the one that Ender and his Jeesh fought and won from what they thought was a training game on the asteroid Eros. One whole volume was about the development of battle school, short biographies of dozens of children who were pivotal to the improvements in the school that eventually led to truly effective training and the legendary battle room games. Peter saw what she wrote about Graf and Rackham, and about the kids in Ender's Jeesh, including Petra. And even though he knew part of her insight came from having Ender right there with her in Shakespeare Colony, the real source of the book's excellence was her own keen self-questioning. She did not find themes and impose them on the history. Things happened, and they were connected to each other. But when a motive was unknowable, she didn't pretend to know it. Yet she understood human beings, even the awful ones she seemed to love. So he thought, too bad she isn't here to write a biography of Petra. Though, of course, that was silly. She didn't have to be there. She had access to any documents she wanted through the Ansible, since one of the key provisions of Graf's Coleman was the absolute assurance that every colony had complete access to every library and repository of records in all the human worlds. It wasn't until the seventh volume came out, and Peter read The Hive Queen, that he found the biographer that made him think, "I want him to write about me." The Hive Queen wasn't long, and while it was well written, it wasn't particularly poetic. It was very simple. But it painted a picture of the Hive Queens that was as they might have written it themselves, the monsters that had frightened children for more than a century and continued to do so even though all were now dead, suddenly became beautiful and tragic. But it wasn't a propaganda job. The terrible things they did were recognized, not dismissed. And then it dawned on him who wrote it. Not Valentine, who rooted things in fact. It was written by someone who could understand an enemy so well that he loved him. How often had he heard Petra quote what Ender said about that? She, or Bean, or somebody, had written it down. "I think it's impossible to really understand somebody, what they want, what they believe, and not love them the way they love themselves." That's what the writer of The Hive Queen, who called himself Speaker for the Dead, had done for the aliens who once haunted our nightmares. And the more people read that book, the more they wished they had understood their enemy, that the language barrier had not been insuperable, that the Hive Queens had not all been destroyed. The Speaker for the Dead had made humans love their ancient enemy. Fine, it's easy to love your enemies after they're safely dead. But still, humans give up their villains only reluctantly. It had to be Ender. And so Peter had written to Valentine congratulating her, but also asking her to invite Ender to write about him. There was some back and forth with Peter insisting that he didn't want approval of anything. He wanted to talk to his brother. If a book emerged from it, fine. If the book painted him to be a monster, if that's what the Speaker for the Dead saw in him, so be it. Because I know that whatever he writes, it'll be a lot closer than most of the Kuso that gets published here. Valentine scoffed at his use of words like Kuso. "What are you doing using battle school slang?" "It's just part of the language now," Peter told her in an answering email. And then she wrote, "He won't email you. He doesn't know you anymore, he says. The last he saw of you, he was 5 years old, and you were the worst older brother in the world. He has to talk to you." That's expensive, Peter wrote back, but in fact he knew the FPE could afford it and would not refuse him. What really held him back was fear. He had forgotten that Ender had only known him as a bully, had never seen him struggle to build a world government, not by conquest, but by free choice of the people, voting nation by nation. "He doesn't know me." But then Peter told himself, yes, he does. The Peter that he knew is part of the Peter who became hegemon. The Peter that Petra agreed to marry and permitted to raise children with her, that Peter was the same one that had terrorized Ender and Valentine and was filled with venom and resentment at having been deemed unworthy by the judges who chose which children would grow up to save the world. How much of my achievement was the acting out of that resentment? "He should interview Mother," Peter wrote back. "She's still lucid, and she likes me better than she used to." "He writes to her," said Valentine. "When he has time to write to anyone, he takes his duties here very seriously. It's a small world, but he governs it as carefully as if it were Earth." Finally, Peter swallowed his fears and set a date and a time, and now he sat down at the vocal interface of the Ansible in the Blackstream Interstellar Communication Center. Of course, BICC didn't communicate directly with any Ansible except Coleman's stationary Ansible array, which relayed everything to the appropriate colony or starship. Audio and video were so wasteful of bandwidth that they were routinely compressed and then reinflated at the other end. So despite the instantaneity of Ansible communications, there was a noticeable time lag between sides of the conversation. No picture. Peter had to draw the line somewhere. And Ender hadn't insisted. It would be too painful for both of them, for Ender to see how much time had passed during his relativistic voyage out to Shakespeare, and for Peter to be forced to see how young Ender still was, how much life he still had ahead of him, while Peter was looking coolly at his own old age and approaching death. "I'm here, Ender. It's good to hear your voice, Peter." And then silence. "No small talk, is there?" said Peter. "It's been too long a time for me, too brief a time for you. Ender, I know I was a slum bitch to you as a kid. No excuses. I was full of rage and shame, and I took it out on you and Valentine, but mostly on you. I don't think I ever said a kind thing to you, not when you were awake, anyway. I can talk about that, if you want." "Later, maybe," said Ender. "This isn't a family therapy session. I just want to know what you did and why." "Which things I did?" "The ones that matter to you," said Ender. "What you choose to tell me is as important as what you say about those events." "There's a lot. My mind is still clear. I remember a lot." "Good. I'm listening." He listened for hours that day, and more hours, more days. Peter poured out everything. The political struggles, the wars, the negotiations, the essays on the nets, building up intelligence networks, seizing opportunities, finding worthwhile allies. It wasn't until near the end of their last session that Peter dredged up memories of when Ender was a baby. "I really loved you, kept begging Mom to let me feed you, change you, play with you. I thought you were the best thing that ever existed. But then I noticed I'd be playing with you and have you laughing, and then Valentine would walk into the room, and you'd just rivet on her. I didn't exist anymore." "She was luminous. Of course you reacted that way. Everybody did. I did. But at the same time, I was just a kid. I saw it as Ender loves Valentine more than me, and when I realized that you were born because they regarded me as a failure, the battle school people, I mean, It was just one more resentment. That doesn't excuse anything. I didn't have to be a bastard about it. I'm just telling you. I realize now that's where it started. Okay, said Ender. I'm sorry, said Peter, that I wasn't better to you as a kid, because, see, my whole life, all the things I've told you about and all these incredibly expensive conversations, I would find myself thinking, that was okay. I did okay that time. Ender would like that I did that. Please don't tell me you did it all for me. Are you kidding? I did it because I'm as competitive a Marubo as ever was born on this planet. But my standard of judgment was, Ender would like that I did that. Ender didn't answer. Hell, kid. It's way simpler than that. What you did by the time you were 12 made my whole life's work possible. Well, Peter, what you did while I was voyaging, that's what made my victory worth winning. What a family Mr. and Mrs. Wigan had. I'm glad we talked, Peter. Me too. I think I can write about you. I hope so. Even if I can't, though, it doesn't mean I wasn't glad to find out who you grew up to be. Wish I could be there, said Peter, to see who you grow up to be. I'm never going to grow up, Peter, said Ender. I'm frozen in history. Forever 12. You had a good life, Peter. Give Petra my love. Tell her I miss her. And the others. But especially her. You got the best of us, Peter. At that moment, Peter almost told him about Bean and his three children flying through space somewhere, waiting for a cure that didn't look very promising now. But then he realized he couldn't. The story wasn't his to tell. If Ender wrote about it, then people would start looking for Bean. Somebody might try to contact him. Someone might call him home. And then his voyage would have been for nothing. His sacrifice. His satyagraha. They never spoke again. Peter lived for some time after that, despite his weak heart, hoping the whole time that Ender might write the book he wanted. But when he died, the book was still unwritten.
So it was Petra who read the short biography called, simply, The Hegemon, and signed Speaker for the Dead. She wept all day after reading it. She read it aloud at Peter's grave, stopping whenever any passers-by came near, until she realized that they were coming in order to hear her reading. So she invited them over and read it aloud again, from the beginning. The book wasn't long, but there was power in it. To Petra, it was everything Peter had wanted it to be. It put a period on his life. The harm and the good, the wars and the peace, the lies and the truth, the manipulation and the liberty. The Hegemon was a companion piece, really, to the Hive Queen. The one book was the story of an entire species, and so was the other. But to Petra, it was the story of the man who had shaped her life more than any other, except one. The one who lived now only as a shadow in other people's stories. The giant. There was no grave, and there was no book to read there. And his story wasn't a human one, because in a way, he hadn't lived a human life. It was a hero's life. It ended with him being taken away into heaven, dying, but not dead. I love you, Peter, she said to him at his grave. But you must have known that I never stopped loving Bean,
and longing for him, and missing him whenever I looked in our children's faces. Then she went home, leaving both her husbands behind, the one whose life had a monument and a book, and the one whose only monument was in her heart.
We hope you have enjoyed The Shadow of the Giant, an audio renaissance audiobook from Tor Books. This program was produced by Stefan Rudnicki. Text copyright 2005 by Orson Scott Card. Production copyright 2005 Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrinck Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.